A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about how we treat restaurants like they've always been with us, like they're just part of the furniture of civilization. But the actual restaurant, the thing where you walk in, sit at your own table, pick from a menu of individually priced dishes, and pay after you eat, that specific arrangement is only about 260 years old. And the question is, why did it take so long? And what does its history tell us about where eating out is headed right now?
This is one of those topics where the first fact just upends everything you assumed. Because you think, surely the Romans had restaurants, surely there were restaurants in medieval times, and there were places you could eat. Absolutely. But they weren't restaurants, they were something fundamentally different.
What's the difference? If I'm hungry in ancient Rome, and I walk into a place and someone gives me food, how is that not a restaurant?
The difference is choice and privacy. In an inn, or a tavern, or a Roman thermopolium, you sat at a communal table, you ate whatever was being served that day, at whatever time they decided to serve it, and you paid a fixed price. There was no menu. You didn't get to decide what you ate, when you ate it, or who you sat with. The cook decided all of that. You were essentially a guest in someone else's house, even if you were paying.
The pre-restaurant world was basically every dinner party where the host insists on cooking for you, except you're also paying for the privilege.
And that model existed for thousands of years. The Thermopolium in ancient Rome, for example, they had these stone counters with jars of hot food built into them. Archaeologists have found dozens of them in Pompeii. But they were basically fast food counters where you stood, ate quickly, and left. No tables, no menu, no lingering. And in medieval Europe, if you were traveling, you stayed at an inn where you ate at a common table with everyone else, and the innkeeper served one meal. That was it.
Which makes the actual restaurant, when it finally appears, sound almost radically individualistic. Like the Enlightenment decided that even lunch needed personal autonomy.
That's not far off. The restaurant as we know it was born in Paris in the 1760s, and the word itself tells the story. Restaurant originally didn't mean a place where you eat. It meant a restorative broth, a bouillon meant to restore your health. The verb restaurer in French means to restore. So the first restaurants were essentially health food shops selling concentrated meat broths.
When I say I'm going to a restaurant, I'm etymologically saying I'm going to a restorative broth, which honestly, after some meals, feels accurate.
The man credited with opening the first one was named Mathurin Rose de Chantoiseau. Around 1765 or 1766, sources disagree on the exact year. He opened an establishment at 59 Rue de Richelieu in Paris. And he sold these restorative broths, these restaurants. But here's what made it revolutionary. He didn't just sell broth, he offered individual tables. You could come at hours that suited you, not at a fixed mealtime. And crucially, he introduced a menu, a written list of options with individual prices.
That's the technical innovation here, isn't it? Not the food, not the building, not even the service. The menu is a list of choices with prices attached.
That's the mechanism. Before the menu, the cook decided what you ate. After the menu, you decided. It shifted power from the producer to the consumer. And that shift is so complete that we don't even think about it now. But imagine walking into a place and being told what you're eating with no alternatives. That was normal for most of human history.
Like showing up at a friend's house and their mom just puts a plate in front of you. Except you're paying for it.
There's a cultural context here that matters. This is the Enlightenment. This is the era of individual rights, of personal autonomy, of the idea that people should make choices about their own lives. The restaurant fits perfectly into that philosophical moment. You're also seeing the rise of a bourgeois class in Paris, people with disposable income who wanted privacy and refinement but weren't aristocrats. They couldn't afford private chefs, but they could afford to eat out occasionally at a place that treated them like individuals.
The food itself, the restorative broth. That's also very Enlightenment, isn't it? The idea that food is medicine, that you can rationally optimize your health through what you consume.
The early restaurant menus were obsessed with health. They offered broths, simple roasted meats, light dishes that were supposed to be easy on the digestion. The whole pitch was, "You're a sensitive, modern person with a delicate constitution, and we will restore you." It was almost a wellness trend.
The first restaurants were basically goop with tables.
I mean, yes, that's not wrong. Gwyneth Paltrow would have thrived in 1760s Paris.
Of course she would have.
The real explosion happens after the French Revolution in 1789. When the aristocracy fell, all these chefs who had been cooking in private noble households suddenly needed work, so they opened their own restaurants. And they brought with them the elaborate cuisine of the aristocracy, but now available to anyone who could pay. The restaurant democratized fine dining.
Which is a pattern we see over and over. Some luxury good or service that was previously only available to the ultra-wealthy gets repackaged for the broader public. The restaurant is one of the earliest examples of that.
The numbers bear this out. Before the revolution, Paris had fewer than 50 restaurants. By 1814, it had over 3,000. The restaurant had become a defining institution of Parisian life. And from there, it spread. London got its first French-style restaurant in the early 1800s. Then New York. Delmonico's opened in 1837 and is usually cited as America's first fine dining restaurant. It introduced the à la carte menu to America, meaning you could order individual dishes rather than a fixed meal.
Within about 70 years, you go from one guy selling broth on the Rue de Richelieu to Delmonico's in New York, serving à la carte to American diners. That's an astonishingly fast spread for a pre-industrial institution.
It helps that the idea was so compelling. Once you've experienced choice and privacy in dining, going back to the communal table and the fixed meal feels like a step backward. The restaurant solved a genuine human desire that inns and taverns had simply ignored for centuries.
That's the origin story of the sit-down restaurant. But the prompt also asks about more informal places, sandwich bars, takeaways, and that feels like a completely different lineage.
And here's the wild thing, it starts at almost exactly the same time. The sandwich was invented in 1762 by John Montagu, the 4th Earl of Sandwich. The story goes that he was gambling and didn't want to leave the table to eat, so he asked for meat between two slices of bread. Whether that specific story is true or not, the sandwich as a concept emerges in the 1760s, right when the restaurant is being born in Paris.
1762 for the sandwich, 1765 for the restaurant. Something was in the air.
The sandwich shop as a commercial establishment takes much longer to emerge. The sandwich was initially an aristocratic convenience, something you ate at home or had prepared for travel. It wasn't until the late 19th century, with the growth of urban working classes, that the sandwich shop becomes a thing. Workers needed quick, cheap lunches they could eat near their workplaces. The sandwich was perfect for that.
Because it's portable, it doesn't require utensils, you can eat it standing up, and it's cheap to produce. It's basically the minimum viable meal.
And that brings us to what I think is the real prototype of modern fast food, the fish and chip shop. The first one was opened by Joseph Mallon in London's East End in 1860. And this is a radically different model from the Parisian restaurant. No tables, no service, no menu in the restaurant sense. You walk up, you order, they wrap it in paper, you leave. It's designed for eating on the street.
There are technological enablers here, right? This doesn't happen without certain material conditions.
That's what makes this so interesting from a systems perspective. The fish and chip shop required cheap frying oil, which became available through new industrial refining processes. It required mass-produced paper for wrapping. Before cheap paper, you couldn't really do takeaway. And crucially, it required the railway network. The railways brought fresh fish from coastal ports to inland cities quickly enough that it wouldn't spoil. Without the railways, fish and chips remains a coastal thing.
The fish and chip shop is really a product of the Industrial Revolution. It's an industrial food system disguised as a humble corner shop.
It spread incredibly fast. By 1900, there were an estimated 35,000 fish and chip shops in Britain. That's more than there are McDonald's locations in the United States today. This was a massive phenomenon, and it predates what Americans think of as fast food by over half a century.
I feel like this is the misconception that needs busting. Most people assume fast food is a 20th century American invention, but the takeaway model, food prepared quickly, wrapped to go, eaten on the street, that's Victorian England.
It was deeply tied to the working class. Fish and chips was cheap, filling, and required no domestic kitchen infrastructure. If you lived in crowded housing without proper cooking facilities, which was common in industrial cities, the fish and chip shop was essential. It wasn't a treat, it was infrastructure.
We've got two parallel lineages now. The Parisian restaurant, which is about choice and privacy and the experience of being served, and the English takeaway, which is about speed and portability and price. They're solving completely different problems.
And the 20th century is where these lineages start to merge and mutate. The big innovation of the 1900s is the chain. White Castle, founded in 1921 in Wichita, Kansas, is usually considered the first fast food hamburger chain. And what they did was apply industrial logic to the restaurant kitchen.
What does that mean, industrial logic?
Standardization, division of labor, assembly line production. At White Castle, every burger was made exactly the same way. The patties were uniform, the cooking process was broken down into discrete steps performed by different workers, and the whole system was designed for speed and consistency. They sold burgers for 5 cents each. The building itself was standardized, white porcelain, stainless steel, visibly clean. The architecture was part of the marketing. It said, "This is a factory, but a clean one, and you can trust it."
Which is fascinating, because the Parisian restaurant was all about individuality. Your own table, your own choices, your own pace. The chain restaurant says the opposite. We've removed all variation. You will get exactly the same thing in Wichita as you will in Kansas City.
People loved it. Consistency was a feature, not a bug. If you were traveling, you knew what you were getting. There was no risk. The chain restaurant is basically the culinary equivalent of a guarantee.
Then McDonald's takes it further in the 1940s and 50s. The speedy service system, which is just an assembly line for hamburgers.
Richard and Maurice McDonald redesigned their kitchen in 1948 specifically to eliminate the need for skilled cooks. Every task was simplified and standardized. You didn't need to know how to cook. You just needed to perform a specific motion at a specific time. It was the tailorization of the kitchen. Scientific management applied to hamburgers.
Then the drive-through, which, when you think about it, strips away the last remaining element of the original restaurant.
The first drive-through is disputed. Red's Giant Hamburg in Springfield, Missouri, opened in 1947, and In-N-Out Burger in Baldwin Park, California, opened in 1948. But whoever was first, the concept was the same. You don't even leave your car. The restaurant becomes a window and a parking lot. The post-war suburban boom made this essential. Cities were designed around cars, and dining had to adapt.
Let's trace what's been stripped away at each stage. The original Parisian restaurant gives you a private table, a menu of choices, flexible hours, and table service. The fish and chip shop removes the table, the service, and the lingering. You eat on the street. The fast food chain removes the menu variety and the human skill of the cook. Everything is standardized. The drive-thru removes the building itself. You stay in your car.
Then the ghost kitchen removes the customer entirely.
This is where we are now. Explain ghost kitchens for anyone who hasn't encountered the term.
A ghost kitchen, also called a dark kitchen or cloud kitchen, is a commercial food production facility with no dining room, no storefront, no customers. It exists solely to prepare food for delivery. You order through an app, the kitchen makes it, a driver picks it up, and it arrives at your door. The customer never sees the restaurant.
This isn't some tiny niche thing. I saw a Technomic report from early this year saying ghost kitchens now account for about 18% of all restaurant orders in the U.S.
The first one was Green Summit in Chicago, founded in 2015. It was a delivery-only kitchen that operated multiple virtual restaurant brands out of a single facility. The same kitchen might be making sushi under one brand name and burgers under another. The customer has no idea. From their perspective, they're ordering from a sushi restaurant or a burger joint, but physically, it's all coming from the same industrial kitchen in a warehouse district.
The ghost kitchen takes the logic of the chain restaurant, standardization, efficiency, division of labor, and applies it to the delivery economy. But it also introduces something new, which is the decoupling of the brand from the physical space.
That's the key innovation. A ghost kitchen can launch a new restaurant brand in a week. They don't need to build a dining room, hire servers, or find a good location. They just need a kitchen, a menu, and a listing on the delivery apps. If the brand doesn't work, they kill it and launch another one. It's the restaurant as software startup. Move fast, break things, pivot.
This was already growing before COVID, but the pandemic supercharged it. When dining rooms closed, delivery became the only option. And a lot of restaurant owners realized they didn't actually need the dining room.
The economics are compelling. A traditional restaurant spends a huge portion of its budget on front of house, rent for a prime location, servers, bussers, hosts, decor, ambiance. A ghost kitchen eliminates all of that. You can operate out of a cheap industrial space, and your labor costs are much lower. The trade-off is that you're entirely dependent on delivery platforms, which take a significant cut, usually 15 to 30%.
You're trading rent and labor for platform fees. Whether that math works depends on volume and margins.
It's creating some strange outcomes. There are now restaurants that exist only as listings on DoorDash or Uber Eats. You can't visit them, you can't call them, they have no physical presence. And sometimes, multiple virtual brands share the same kitchen. So you and your neighbor might order from what you think are two different restaurants, but your food was made by the same person on the same grill.
That feels like a genuinely new phase in the history of eating out. The original restaurant was defined by a relationship between the diner and the establishment. You went there, you sat down, you interacted with people. The ghost kitchen dissolves that relationship entirely. The restaurant becomes a pure abstraction, a brand, a menu, and a set of delivery coordinates.
This raises questions that go beyond food. If restaurants become invisible production facilities, what happens to the public square? Restaurants have been a huge part of urban social life for two centuries. They're where people gather, where deals are made, where communities form. What does a city look like when a significant chunk of its food service has no public face?
It's the atomization of dining. Everyone eating separately in their own homes, food arriving from invisible kitchens. It's convenient, but it's also...
That's the tension. The history of the restaurant is a history of increasing convenience and decreasing social friction. Each innovation removes some obstacle. The fixed mealtime, the communal table, the limited choices, the need to leave your car, the need to leave your house. But at each step, something social was lost. The ghost kitchen is the logical endpoint of that trajectory. Maximum convenience, minimum social interaction.
Where does this go next? You mentioned AI-driven menu optimization and robotic kitchens.
These are already happening. There are companies building robotic arms that can flip burgers and assemble bowls without human intervention. There are AI systems that analyze order data and automatically adjust menus, adding items that are trending, removing ones with low margins, even tweaking prices in real time based on demand. And these systems feed directly into the ghost kitchen model. If you don't have a public-facing brand to protect, you can optimize ruthlessly.
Imagine a ghost kitchen that's fully automated. No human cooks, no servers, no delivery drivers. Eventually, autonomous vehicles handle the last mile. The entire system is managed by AI that adjusts the menu based on what's selling. You open an app, an algorithm suggests what you might want based on your past orders, and the weather, and the time of day. You tap a button, and 40 minutes later a robot drops food at your door.
That sounds like science fiction, but every piece of that system exists in some form right now. The integration is the hard part, but it's coming. And when it arrives, it will be as different from a traditional restaurant as a fish and chip shop was from a Parisian bouillon stall.
The restaurant that Mathurin Rose de Chantoiseau opened in 1765 would be unrecognizable to someone living in ancient Rome. And the restaurant of 2065 might be unrecognizable to us.
Here's what I think persists. The core human desire, to have someone else cook for you, in a way that feels intentional and satisfying, that doesn't go away. The form changes, but the need is constant. People have always wanted to eat food. They didn't have to prepare themselves, in circumstances that feel good. The restaurant, the takeaway, the drive-thru, the ghost kitchen, they're all different answers to the same question. How do I get fed without cooking, and how do I feel good about it?
That's the through line. And each era answers it differently based on what technology allows and what culture values. The Parisians valued privacy and choice. The Victorians valued speed and price. The post-war Americans valued consistency and convenience. And now we value frictionlessness, the ability to summon food without even thinking about it.
I think the question for the next decade is whether that frictionlessness is actually satisfying. there's some evidence that people are starting to feel the loss of the social dimension. The pandemic made delivery essential, but it also made people realize how much they miss restaurants as places. The dining room might make a comeback, not because it's efficient, but because it's human.
Or we might see a hybrid, ghost kitchens that occasionally open pop-up dining experiences. The restaurant as a special event rather than a daily utility.
That's already happening. Some virtual brands are experimenting with periodic physical presences. A weekend pop-up, a collaboration with a bar, a limited-run tasting menu. The kitchen is always there producing delivery orders, but once a month, they open the doors and serve 40 people. It's the restaurant as concert, not as radio.
Which is almost a return to the original model in a weird way. The first restaurants were special places you went to for a particular experience. They weren't everyday utilities. Then they became ubiquitous. Now maybe they're becoming special again.
The restaurant started as a luxury, became a commodity, and might end up as a luxury again. But a different kind of luxury. Not luxury in the sense of expensive ingredients and formal service, but luxury in the sense of presence. The luxury of being in a room with other people, eating food that was made for you by someone you can see.
That's a nice thought. Although I suspect the ghost kitchen operators would point out that most people, most of the time, just want dinner to show up with minimal friction.
Both things can be true. The history of eating out isn't a single line, it's a branching tree. Different models for different needs. The Parisian restaurant didn't disappear when fish and chips arrived. The drive-thru didn't kill the sit-down diner. Ghost kitchens won't eliminate traditional restaurants. They'll just occupy a different niche.
If a listener wants to apply this, what should they do? What's the practical takeaway?
I think the prompt is actually a useful lens. Next time you eat out, ask yourself, what model is this place built on? Is it the 1760s Parisian model with a menu and individual tables and service? Is it the Victorian takeaway model designed for speed and portability? Is it the 20th century chain model built on standardization and consistency? Or is it the ghost kitchen model where the brand might not even correspond to a physical location you can visit?
The answer tells you a lot about the economics of the place, the culture it's embedded in, and what it's actually offering you beyond the food.
A fine dining restaurant with tablecloths and a sommelier is selling you an experience. A ghost kitchen is selling you pure convenience. They're both valid, but they're radically different products, and understanding that helps you make better choices about where you spend your money and why.
The other thing I'd say is, pay attention to your own city's zoning laws and delivery app data. The ghost kitchen transformation is happening in real time, and it's visible if you know where to look. Warehouses in industrial zones that suddenly have a lot of delivery traffic. Restaurant brands on DoorDash that have no corresponding address on Google Maps. It's a hidden geography being built around us.
It raises real policy questions. Labor conditions in ghost kitchens are often worse than in traditional restaurants. Less oversight, more pressure for speed, fewer pathways to better jobs. Urban planners are starting to worry about what happens to commercial districts if dining rooms keep closing. These aren't just food stories, they're labor stories and city stories.
The restaurant has always been about more than food. That's the thread running through the whole history.
Now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
And now, Hilbert's Daily Fun Fact.
In the 1780s, the Ottoman cartographer and admiral Piri Reis included detailed chemical analyses of ink compositions in his geographical notes on Tierra del Fuego, specifying the precise ratios of lampblack, gum arabic, and iron gall required to produce maps that would not fade in the region's extreme humidity.
Right.
I have questions about how an Ottoman admiral from the 1500s was doing chemical analysis in the 1780s, but I suspect the answer would only confuse me more. To wrap this up, the restaurant as we know it is only about 260 years old. It was born in Paris as a health food concept, exploded during the French Revolution, and has been reinvented multiple times since. Each reinvention stripped away something that seemed essential. The communal table, the menu, the server, the dining room, the building itself. And we're living through another reinvention right now, with ghost kitchens and AI-driven optimization changing what it means to eat out.
The open question is, what the next 50 years bring? Will the dining room survive? Will menus become algorithmic, personalized to each diner based on their purchase history and biometric data? Will the restaurant as a physical space become a luxury good while everyday eating becomes a purely logistical transaction? I don't know the answers. But knowing that the restaurant has always been a moving target, that it's never been a stable ancient institution, makes it easier to see the current changes clearly instead of just reacting to them.
Maybe that's the real takeaway. The things that feel permanent in our daily lives often turn out to be surprisingly recent inventions. The restaurant, the menu, the idea that you can choose what you eat and eat it in private, these are products of a specific time and place. They weren't inevitable, and neither is whatever comes next.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping this show running. This has been My Weird Prompts. You can find every episode at myweirdprompts.com.
If you enjoyed this, leave us a review wherever you listen. It helps more people find the show. We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.